Welcome home, neighbors. This is Mike Doherty from Sorrento, Florida, and owner at Copper Creek Villas and Cabins. You're listening to My DVC Points.
Parents and the children could have fun together.
Please board quickly and safely. Our monorail will be departing momentarily.
Welcome to the My DVC Points podcast. Join the conversation as DVC members share their stories, personal preferences, and magical memories. Your reservation is confirmed. Your fast passes are booked. Pull up on the yellow strap because our journey into the magic of membership is about to begin.
To infinity and beyond.
Now, here's your host and curator of magical stories, Chad Pennycuff.
Welcome home, neighbors, to episode 22 of the My DVC Points podcast. Today's show is brought to you in conjunction with thethinglive.com. That is Terry Weaver's event that's going on this May in Orlando. It's for anybody who's creating, anybody who's pursuing a hobby, an idea, something they'd like to get off the ground and turn into a viable business. thethinglive.com. As a matter of fact, today's guest, Craig McNair Wilson, will be a keynote speaker. I have to use his full name because he spent, well, around a decade or so at Disney Imagineering, and anybody who's an Imagineer will know him as Craig Wilson. For those of us who met him afterwards, he started using the name McNair. In today's interview, I do need to apologize briefly for some audio quality issues, and it's not from lack of trying. I spent over $200 getting McNair some pro gear under this theory that guys like him that are kind of the second generation of Imagineers, and as you'll hear in today's show, his first day there was a very special retirement party of Gen 1 engineers. I'll put that out there as a teaser, a little bit of setup for this interview. Before I hit the record button today, I kind of shared with him, I'm like, McNair, we need to know where your fingerprints are left in the park. You spent a decade or so at Disney Imagineering. I know you contributed on a bazillion projects while you were there. Let's start listing them off and start seeing where your ideas, your influence, and your fingerprints, so to speak, are still left in the Disney park. I'm willing to bet that there is not a listener out there listening to this episode today that hasn't experienced something that McNair directly touched or indirectly contributed on their Disney stays. Well, I'd like to welcome to the show today my friend McNair Wilson. How are you doing today, McNair?
McNair, he's on live?
He is on live.
Oh, I want to hear this.
He's worth hearing.
I hope so. Otherwise, why bother? Hi, Chad. How are you?
I am doing great, my friend. Hey, I would like to just introduce you and let everybody know that you're going to be our celebrity judge for our Franken Resort shows. I brought you on the show today to tell me a little bit about your backstory and your history and how you winded up in Walt Disney Imagineering.
Kadoke. Oh, my turn. I have a long background in the theater, and part of that is street theater. And some friends of mine formed a company in 1977 called SAC Theater, S-A-K. And we made the rounds of 25, 30 Renaissance festivals a year, troops of four or five people in each festival, doing audience participation street theater. The Disney Entertainment, specifically Epcot Entertainment Squad, discovered us, quote unquote, at a little festival near St. Pete, Florida, in the spring of 1982, just prior to Epcot open. And we'd heard rumors that they were looking for a street theater troupe. And anyway, long story short, they came, they saw us, they loved us. 2 days later, we were in the offices, and the head of entertainment, there's Peter Blaustein, said, well, you know, we're looking for this and this and this. And I said, tell you what, Peter, we know what you're looking for, some street theater for Italy at Epcot. You've seen what we do and you love it. Why don't we pretend we're going to work together? And then what would that look like? And he said, well, that cuts about 2 or 3 hours of BS out of my life. And we had a lot of time, so he didn't say BS. He said the whole word. A couple minutes later, we had a letter of agreement. A month later, we came down, did a couple of our shows over at what was then the Walt Disney World Shopping Village for 150 Disney executives. They went crazy in a positive way. They were a little concerned at our sarcasm, but we said our humor by company policy is powder blue. We offend only the innocent. And the head of Disney World liked that. He was a big fan. Eventually, actually, his daughter-in-law came to work for us, one of our favorite people. So opening day of Epcot, we were there. We moved down 82 September, so we had a month of rehearsal at the Contemporary Resort. We were there for soft opening and opening and so on. They liked us right away. We were scheduled to do 10 shows a day in Italy. By Thanksgiving of that year, we brought in another troupe. So then we moved to, we had Italy and the United Kingdom doing 12 shows a day. And by 1984, 85, we were doing 45 shows a day. We had three different projects, troupes in Future World. And so we were very, very, very involved. So a three-month contract became a seven-year contract. And we contracted it a year at a time.
What were some of the shows that you did so that we can refresh the audience's
sure.
memory?
Well, for example, in our best-known show was Romeo and Juliet in the streets of UK. And we started out, we were doing it in Italy. In Italy, we were called Il Teatro di Bologna, Bologna Theater. And in the UK, we were called the Renaissance Street Theater Company, which I didn't like, but that's, you know, it's generic and it was fun. Romeo and Juliet, for example, somebody would come out and do a pre-show, gather a crowd in the streets, get a few people to sit down while the other two people would be out. We just took two or three of us to do a show out on the main drag of World Showcase, pulling people in. When the pre-show was done, we divide the audience into Capulets and Montagues. And out of the Capulets, we would pull Juliet, and out of the Montagues, pull Romeo. We had at one point 17 street theater shows. 15 of them began by selecting a male senior citizens because we were about to bring people up, quote unquote, on stage. And, you know, you worried that people worried we're going to make fun of you. So we'd pick a male first. We'd pick a senior citizen because they were more game. If you were 30 to 45, you were probably never in a SAC theater show because they were the least likely to jump in, or teenage girls. They're just very self-conscious. And you never pick somebody who had a goofy hat and was sitting on the front row going, pick me, pick me, pick me, because they'd get on stage and they'd go nuts. And so we'd give them a line or two of dialogue, you know, like Romeo, we'd put a little cape on him. And the cape was just a piece of fabric tied in a knot and slipped over the head. So it was very minimal. Sack theater started with a burlap sack full of costumes at Renaissance festivals. And we spelled it S-A-K, so it was our own name, our own word. It's still going as the SAC Comedy Lab in downtown Orlando, improv. They have improv performances virtually every night of the week. They have classes for professionals. They do the comedy festivals across Canada. So those were the shows. In Future World, we had a robot show that was really literally a little robot. And then the person doing the voice was in the crowd with guests and had the microphone in their hand. And you didn't have to talk any louder than this. And then the voice was modulated through a little device, so it made it sound like a little kid. And then the person controlling the robot had a light jacket over their hands, and under the jacket was the controls that made the robot go back and forth and in and out. So that was the little robot show. We had a show called Mr. I or Miss I. I was intelligence, and he was a mad professor, horn-rimmed glasses, but lab coat, high-water pants, and so on. And then he came out with a dolly with a human-size robot on it, and it was one of our cast members as a mime. And that show could only be about 10 minutes and at one point we would hand the controls over to Kid. And at first it would come out, shake hands with people, bow, pat people on the back, very benign. But when you handed the controls to the little kid, and of course the controls did nothing, then the mime went crazy. It would steal ladies' purses, it would mess up people's hair, it would pull on people's clothing. That was a lot of fun. The most fun show, when I, for example, was doing Mr. I, it was usually in and around under Spaceship Earth and so on. So you're greeting people as they came in. So a 10-minute show, I would spend the balance of the half hour, because we do a show every half hour. I would spend the balance of the time playing with guests just as this nutty professor. And one of my big games was to try to get people out of line at Spaceship Earth to go somewhere else, not spend the first 40 minutes of their life in line at Spaceship Earth. Because at that time, Epcot opened at whatever, 8:39 in the morning, and everything opened all at once. But eventually they went to a place where World Showcase didn't even open till 10 o'clock because nobody could get out there. So they're all standing in line there. So I try to encourage people to go over to Living Seas or Universe of Energy, whatever.
Yeah, that's still a problem today. Everybody goes to Spaceship Earth right at rope drop. Yeah.
We call them Future Sweaters of America because they're like sheep. And the good news about that is when you're doing a street theater show, all you need to do is get a small crowd, have them make a lot of noise, and that draws a bigger crowd. And we would even say that, now, ladies and gentlemen, I need your help. If you'll stand here on the count of three, go crazy. It'll be a short trip for you, sir. You'll go crazy. Everyone come rushing over. And when the real audience gets here, you all can go on your merry way. Well, they wouldn't. They'd all stay. And we would have typically several hundred people watching one of our shows without a stage, just by the noise. And we've been doing that since our first day at Renaissance Festivals. We never used the stages at Renaissance Festivals. We'd just be out in the open. Because at a Renaissance Festival, the ones where we're very well known, Maryland, Minnesota, so on, Houston, we would have 1,000 or more people watching one of our shows and then pass the hat. We didn't pass the hat at Disney. That would have been great. And then the third show in Future World was this old retirement couple. They were guests, Gutfred and Myrtle Nerdstrom. And they were just these old, funky senior citizens. And it was just two actors in their 30s or 40s. And they would get lost in line, say, at Imagination or Universe of Energy, get separated, couldn't find each other. So they'd be shouting, Gutfred, Myrtle, my wife, Myrtle, she doesn't like to do the dishes, so I got a dishwasher. And then Myrtle would say, well, that's no good, because we use paper plates, and it just messes up the dishwasher. Or she'd say, oh, he's so slow, takes him an hour and a half to watch 60 minutes. Just funny stuff. We started doing first at cocktail parties at convention shows, and people loved it. But the Epcot Entertainment people were worried that if you did this senior citizens couple, people would feel like we're making fun of them. Well, they did in one way. If you were there with your wife thought that Gutfred was you, but she never saw herself in Myrtle and vice versa. So nobody self-identified with the character that was their sex, but they certainly said, well, that's my husband. Now, he's just like that. And what it did was it entertained the longer lines in Future World, and it turned it into an audience. And so from that, I came up with the idea of doing these themed street characters that would be assigned to different large attractions, first in the Magic Kingdom and then in Epcot. And we went out and tested it. And one of my favorites was this Undertaker at the Haunted Mansion. And I wore one of the Haunted Mansion green tuxedos, but I got an old one that was kind of dusty and faded and so on. We put a dead flower as a boutonniere on his lapel. I had a tape measure like you'd use at a like a tailor would use to measure, just kind of fabric around my neck. I had a shovel over my shoulder. And I'd go up to somebody, usually a man, that was smoking, and I'd say, oh, we'll be seeing you very soon, sir. And I'd start to measure his shoulders and his length, and I'd say, look at his wife and say, what do you think? A nice pine box with some silver handles, and entertain the guests while they're in line at the Haunted Mansion. Well, it was so popular, Chad. I'm wearing a microphone, the whole thing was videotaped by our video crew from Imagineering. It was so popular, they had to send out two or three additional cast members in Haunted Mansion outfits to keep the line moving, because I would turn the line into an audience. And that was the idea that people forget. And it's what I did with the Nutty Professor at the lines at Future World. I got people to forget they're in line, and they wouldn't move. So they had to please keep the line moving. I'd say, keep the line moving. If you were behind you, you'd want you to walk faster, wouldn't you? So on. So we did the Undertaker at the Haunted Mansion, a baggage handler at Star Tours. Where's everybody going today? Off? Nobody goes to Off this time of year. Go to Tatooine. Tatooine, the pleasure spot, and so on. And so even though those line entertainment things were of great, great success, the management of the Magic Kingdom didn't want to pay for it. Michael Eisner said, this is the most important thing we could do this summer is line entertainment. And then somebody said, well, what's that going to cost? I had a program of 33 different characters. And what we would do is be a cast of about 12 per day. And they'd play one character in the morning, take a break, and then play another character. And one of the top guys said, well, wouldn't people recognize you? I said, I do the Hoop-Dee-Doo review. And it's very frequent that I'll do the Hoop-Dee-Doo review on a Tuesday night. And on Wednesday, they'll see me in my Renaissance outfit at Epcot. And they'll say, didn't we see you last night at Hoop-Dee-Doo Review? I said, curly haired gentleman with a kind of a portly build. Yes, that's my twin brother. He's not very smart. That's why they hide him over there in the trees. But people love the idea that they've figured out that it was me. And they don't want to make a big deal out of it. They just want to know that was it. So I said the same thing. If you saw me as the Undertaker in the morning at the Haunted Mansion, and in the afternoon you saw me as the old gatekeeper inside Fantasyland, people love that. Hey, look at that's that same guy. It wasn't really revealing the magic trick. It's just showing the versatility of our cast. We never, ever did that. Until just a few years ago, they took a few of those characters and did the suffragettes and the mayor for Main Street USA, both at Disneyland and the Magic Kingdom. Well, those are characters that were there at the beginning under Walt. And so that was where I got that. And I'd found a paper where that Marty Sklar, my boss at the time, Imagineer, said, you know, Walt had a riverboat gambler doing card tricks. And I have a friend who's the top card magician in the country, the Richard Turner. He's called the Cheat. You can look him up on YouTube. And he was going to come in and teach some magic tricks to our cast members who would be the riverboat gambler. And so anywhere you'd go in the park, and we would put them in places where the industrial engineers know these rides here are busiest in the morning, these rides here are busiest in the afternoon. So try to get maximum use out of them. And I was in a room with all these guys, and Eisner was there. I said, we've got to do this, got to do this. And they said, what's that going to cost? I said, 10 cents per guest per year. Now, at that time, Disneyland was about 12, 13 million guests. So that's $1.3 million. Well, as a raw number, 1.3 is a million is a big number. But if you figure what that's going to do is turn your longest lines into an audience and make the line wait disappear. It's invaluable to do that, but they didn't.
Oh, absolutely. Was this before the days of fast passes or after? Before. Okay, so that's even better.
You could see the look on the face of a mom or a dad doing the math of how many hours did I have to work for my family to spend an hour and a half in line here, times four or five or six lines. Yeah, one of the reasons that FastPass came in, because of the lines, they had people fainting, keeling over from exhaustion, because they were running from one side of the park to the other to get to certain lines. Because before FastPass, they started doing, even before apps, they had like a Disney MGM Studios, some will remember, at the top of Hollywood Boulevard. In other words, just before you got to what is in essence the hub at Hollywood Boulevard, they had a big chalkboard where they were giving updates of how long the lines were at all the big rides, and then fast passes, and then now you've got all the apps that help you with that. But they just didn't want to spend the money on it. You know, they figured we got everybody's money, why spend more money? Sad. So when we designed Disney MGM Studios, so now 1984, Bob Weiss, who's now president of Imagineering, Randy Bright, who was vice president of creative development at Imagineering, they came out and took a meeting with Herb Hansen and me, that we were co-founders of SAC. And they'd been watching us since before Epcot opened at we did four cast member preview nights at Epcot. And they just loved us, found out we were a separate company. We were not Disney employees. Our company was employed by Disney. And so they said, have you guys got any ideas for making Future World more interesting? So that's when we were just in Italy and the United Kingdom, and we added the three shows over a course of several months to Epcot. And then they invited us out to Imagineering in LA for some consulting times. And we were in a room with about 60 of the top Imagineers. And somebody said, what's it like to work to do what you do that's so unusual in a theme park? And I says, well, you know, the people that run Disney theme parks, I have a question. Do they work for the company? Because they act like they're enemies of the company. Well, the place just erupted. Try to come up with something that will help guests. Like we would take a break and we'd go over to American Adventure and do line entertainment, because in the early days, one out of four, sometimes one out of three shows a day was down for, you know, mechanical problems. That was a big, took them a while to, you know, unwind the American Adventure. It's a great show. I like it to this day, but it had a lot of technical problems. And so when people would leave there not having seen the show or only seen part of it, they'd end up at Italy if they went one direction. And we said, right this way, it's street theater, it's alive, it works every time. Mm-hmm. And the guy that was head of Epcot, who I became friends with, because he'd say, says, you know what offends me when you say that? I said, I'm not here for you. I said, I'm here for our guests who've paid good money to come in, and they've heard about American Adventure, and it doesn't work. So I'm not going to stand there and say, gee, I'm sorry. Well, then we started making monthly trips for a week at a time to Imagineering, working on every conceivable project. And one of the first things they showed us was Michael Eisner. This is now 1985. Michael Eisner had been there just a year, had asked them to come up with a small working movie studio somewhere on property. And then they would have trams that would pick people up at what was still the Disney Shopping Village and bring them over for a small tour. We were on that concept team, and Bob Weiss was put in charge of it. And he says, we're going to do more than they asked for. And that's our favorite thing at Imagineering, was to answer the unasked question. Okay, we'll design the studio. It has to open a year ahead, and then there'll be the theme park element, which was completely an invention of Imagineering to do Hollywood Boulevard and all those attractions. One of the things that Eisner kept saying to me, any street theater, because he loved the street theater at Epcot, as a lot of the top management could. We'd get a memo almost monthly. So-and-so is coming to lunch at Alfredo's, which is the original restaurant in Italy. What time are your street theater shows? And I said, I'm going to make a laminated card for these guys. Italy, every hour of the half hour. United Kingdom, every hour of the hour. Every day of the year, except one day. And what we did was, in order for SAC to have a company-wide party, including some of our Renaissance Festival actors, not all of whom were Epcot actors. Because during the height of the Renaissance Festival season, there would be weekends where we would be in three cities doing Renaissance Festivals with a troupe of six or eight, and still our full complement of 45 shows a day at Epcot. So our annual company party would be 100-plus people. So we always would write the contract so that it ended on Sunday of Thanksgiving and began on the following Tuesday, and then our company party would be that Monday after Thanksgiving weekend. If anybody looked at it, unless they looked closely, they wouldn't notice that there was a missing day every year where we weren't there. And that was only one day that we weren't there. Whereas any of the bands at Epcot, they'd be off sometimes one day a month for rehearsal. It's the only way they could. This is a band of, you know, the Future World Brass or something like that. You know, there'd be a dozen guys, but they couldn't rehearse half of them one day. So SAC was there every day of the year except one day. Only a few people knew about that. Whoever the manager of entertainment at Epcot was, we worked that out. And so it was there 7 years. So meanwhile, we're at Imagineering, dreaming stuff up. And Eisner kept saying, street theater. Fine. And I'd been working on the big outdoor stunt show. And the first stunt show that I designed was a combination of James Bond, Mad Max, and Indiana Jones. Presented it to everybody. They loved the idea. And Eisner said, if you only did one of those characters, what would you do? And I said, well, I think the kind of stunts we could get away with and do that would be interesting live. And it was always the idea that you were watching them film stuff. So the transition from scene to scene would be the crew and all that. So we didn't have to make it a seamless show like seeing a Broadway play. And I said, well, I think I would do Indiana Jones because I think they're going to do a third movie. That's how long ago all this was, people forget. And little bit did we know they're going to do a fourth and now looks like a fifth Indiana Jones movie. So the show had legs. Now, James Bond, they're going to keep going, but most of big James Bond big stunts are speedboats and car chases and those kind of things, which would be tough to replicate live. So I said, I would go with Indiana Jones. So we got the stunt director from Indiana Jones. I got my friend Bob Yerkes, who does all the great falls and the great, you know, Poseidon Adventure and all those, and he trained all the guys to do all the high falls and stuff. So we got, you know, the A-team to train all those people for Indy. So I was involved in stuff that eventually I didn't even get involved in.
Sounds like that's how we got the Indiana Jones stunt show, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I said, let's do Indiana Jones. And Michael says, that makes sense because they're going to do a third movie, which means we could probably do an Indiana Jones show that runs 10 years. Well, it'll be 30 years, 1st of May. So in the middle of all that, going out once a week, we had the groundbreaking for the Disney MGM Studios, and I was at dinner with Marty Sklar, who was head of Imagineering at the time, Bob Weiss, Rick Rothschild, who headed up Pleasure Island. And meanwhile, I got on the Pleasure Island concept design team, which meant I was in the very first group of people who figured out what are the nightclubs going to be. At one point, we had, I think, 20-some different nightclub ideas, a magic club, a jazz club, and so on and so on. In fact, it was a jazz club for the longest time. Then somebody took Michael Eisner to Church Street Station, and he saw the Cheyenne Social Saloon. He said, we got to do country western. And we said, well, we can do a country western club, but it's not going to be Cheyenne Social Saloon. It's huge. We'd have to get rid of Mannequin's Dance Theater. So Neon Armadillo next to the Adventures Club became our country western club. Originally, that space, that building, was our jazz club. And we still had a lot of requests for jazz club after it opened, but the country western thing, I will say, was popular because people who like country western music, if you got a country western club, they'll go there. Anyway, so we're having dinner at Alfredo's, and they're talking about, we'd really like to find somebody, McNair, like you, but to be full-time at Imagineering that's got the theater background in terms of performance, directing, and so on. Imagineering was full of people who had done theater lighting, theater stage design, and all that, but not somebody from the live element. So I'm sitting there trying to think of who do I have in SAC Theater that would be at the level of creativity and so on that they needed Imagineering full time, but not somebody from SAC that was so good that I didn't want to lose them. Meanwhile, Marty Sklar passes his business card down the row of the table. There's about eight of us, yeah. And I said, well, thank you. And he said, look on the back. And it said, wish you were here, Marty. And I says, is this? And he said, yes. When can you come on full time? And I started to cry because I'd wanted that job, Disney Imagineer, since I first saw on the Disney Wonderful World of Color Sunday night program where Walt introduced a man. And he said, this is our head Imagineer for a new project we're building, Disneyland. And he said, Claude, show them what you're working on. And it was Claude Coates showing them a model of Pirates of the Caribbean. This would have been 1964, 65. My first day at Imagineering as a consultant, at the 10 o'clock break on the patio, they had cake and champagne and a presentation of a diamond stud to put in a name tag of an employee who had been there 50 years. And it was Claude Coates. Well, by that time,
oh wow,
I had told Marty my Claude story, and that was the first time I heard the word Imagineer. In fact, when Walt said Imagineer, I yelled it at my mom, Imagineer, what is that? She said, keep listening. And it was, you know, long before the internet, of course. I mean, if they had internet, it would have been steam powered.
Yeah, this would have been back in the days of Walt's original ABC show, correct, on TV.
Exactly. And the show that was first called Disneyland, that was virtually a one-hour weekly hype about Disneyland the park. But in a shrewd deal with ABC, they said, we'll give you a show, and then you can use the revenues from that show to help build Disneyland. It was just one of the great business transactions ever. So Marty took me over, introduced me to Claude. He said, tell him your story. And I told him about having seen him on the Sunday night thing. And since then had wanted to be an Imagineer because of him. And Claude was 6'8", but he was just the gentlest man. And he said, and his favorite word when he liked something was keen. He said, well, that's just a keen story. Thank you for telling me that. Boy, that's great. Well, good to have you on the team. After I got to Imagineering, my second office was just right across the hall from Bob Weiss because I was working on so many different parts of Disney MGM Studios. I mean, I helped create the backlot tour because it was a live performance thing. And as a result of that, I said to Bruce LaValle, who was running the Disney MGM Studios theme park, he'd come over from being one of the two main guys running Epcot. So I'd known him for years. And I said, do you understand how tough this backlot tour thing is going to be? I said, it's going to be so he bumped up the salary and the requirements for that job. Same thing on the Great Movie Ride. I said, Great Movie Ride is going to be the Jungle Cruise of this park. And every park has a ride that they consider this is the tough ride. This is the ride that if you're a ride operator, you want to aspire to. And so it's interesting at Disney World, I've got a friend, Ian Janosko. Ian has been a Jungle Cruise driver, a Great Movie Ride tour guide, and now he's the top guy at Kilimanjaro Safari. And that's kind of the cycle for people at that level. They're the best of the best of cast members of those parks. So it's interesting to be involved in more than just doing a live show, to be involved in how the whole operational thing was. And God bless Bruce LaValle, now retired. He bumped up the status of the Great Movie Ride just to let people park wide. You know, if you want to be doing that, you already need to be at a certain level. Not just anybody could do that. So after Marty giving me his business card, and I said, well, you know, I'm artistic director of a $3 million company that does shows in four Six Flags parks and Epcot and all these Renaissance festivals. I said, it might take me a while to restructure the company, find somebody either to replace me or find some new system for artistic director, because I was in charge of the show quality, scripts, hiring, training of all of our people. And so it was a full year till I went full time at Imagineering. But hit the ground running because I still kept going monthly and was involved in, you know, I was on the team for Typhoon Lagoon. And even though there were no live characters, at one point I came up with a couple of live characters for Typhoon Lagoon that would be wandering around greeting guests. Eventually, Operations, not Imagineering, Operations took those live characters out of Typhoon Lagoon. But meanwhile, and here's the interesting thing, Chad, I think, is that by having those live characters in the mix, it changed and affected in a very positive way the way we designed certain elements of the water park, imagining that this live character would be there.
Really? Now, what's some of the remnants there?
Well, it just, for example, that I don't even know what they call it now, but there was a thing that was the equivalent of Sid Cahuenga's one-of-a-kind shop at Disney MGM Studios. That building is still there, the house, Sid Cahuenga's house, And we hired an actor to be Sid Coenga. In fact, when I first presented the Streetmosphere program for Hollywood Boulevard, and that was the answer to Eisner's, are we going to have street theater? I was in my hotel room one night during my consulting week, and I started to draw these characters, policeman, autograph hound, gossip columnist, and so on. Presented them the next day to the Disney MGM Studios team, and then a couple weeks later to Eisner and the whole, or a couple days later to Eisner and the whole thing. Eisner had this thing that he adapted from Walt. Walt was not one who was given to high praise, but the way he would encourage you, he'd say, you've made a good start here, Chad. Well, that was high praise. If he liked something, the phrase he used was home run. So Eisner was given to say, but not frequently, when he liked something, he said, that's a home run, that's a triple, that's a base hit. He looked at Streetmosphere and did the whole cast of all the different Hollywood Boulevard characters, impersonating each one as I went along. A few of them I would add a hat or something. Got done, and it was quiet, and Eisner was just staring at it. He'd look over at me, he'd look at the bulletin board with all these characters, and he'd said, man, grand slam. And there's some of the Imagineers standing in the background from the studio tour team. Said, grand slam, nobody gets a grand slam. Nobody's ever got a grand slam. He doesn't even work here. Now, I'd already accepted the author, but I wasn't yet on board. And so Marty told Michael that I was going to be coming on staff, so he came over and said, welcome to the family. So it's just really a great, great moment. And by building, because Marty had told me, he and I were walking around World Showcase one day, and we came to China. We were there for a dinner meeting, but we were about an hour early. So we did two laps of World Showcase, just me and Marty Sklar. Unbelievable. You know, second only to meeting Walt. And we got to China, and there's a place in China off to the left. There's this kind of little alleyway, and you walk down, and it goes nowhere. But just the way it's set up, it makes it look like a place, you know, all these little extra things. And Marty says, let me tell you how operations and us work together and don't work together. If you and I tonight came up with an idea that it would be fun to have a cat, a living cat, up on that balcony there every morning drinking a bowl of milk, he said it would be impossible, not difficult, impossible to get park operations to add that. But if we designed it into the park opening day, he said, still, every morning you could come to China at Epcot and you'd see a live cat drinking milk up on the balcony. So he says, you've got to build it intrinsically into the park. So that's what we did with Street Theater and Streetmosphere. And we made Streetmosphere the kind of thing that it was part of the attraction that was the studio tour. And I'll tell you how true that was. Bruce Lavelle, again, the vice president, operating lead of studio tour. I had built into my budget to make, at first, every other week and then monthly trips for the first 2 years to Disney MGM to watch over the cast, even though I had leads and so on. Bruce said, meet me on Hollywood Boulevard at 2:45. I said, okay. 2:45, we went into one of the stores, into the back room, up a staircase, onto the roof of one of the buildings. He said, now look. And at one end of the street was two Streetmosphere characters, and they had a crowd of about 60, 80 people. Another end of the street, you know, so on and so on and so on. And if you counted, there were about 200 guests whose time was being occupied by a handful of Streetmosphere guests. He says, this goes on every day. My engineers have told me that Streetmosphere occupies the time of about 2,000 guests an hour. That makes this an E attraction. That's 2,000 guests that aren't in line for food, aren't running around looking for a short line for an attraction. This is an attraction. He said, as long as I run this park and Bob Lamb is my assistant, if he runs the park, Streetmosphere will be here. And I told the cast, I said, guys, they said, does Disney like this idea? I said, yeah, the top people like this idea, but the top people don't run the park. That's Michael Eisner likes it. I said, if this thing, Streetmosphere is here 10 years from now, it's because everybody recognized a great idea and it held on. It doesn't make sense for Disney to have this little Streetmosphere thing. And one of the terrible things that happened that became one of the wonderful things, on the way home on the corporate plane one time, during soft opening, the park is open for 4 hours a day. Guests, if you're in one of the Disney hotels, can come in for, I think it's $10 or something. Well, Eisner had been to the park several times and never seen Streetmosphere. Well, he had come in the afternoon, and Streetmosphere rehearsed in the morning out in the street because we weren't in costume yet. So we could rehearse and guests didn't know what was going on. And then we were backstage. So he said to Marty, he says, where's McNair Streetmosphere? I never see him. And he said, well, I don't know. He said, well, maybe we should cancel it because if they're not out there very much, who cares? So Marty called me and he said, you know, Michael says we're probably not going to do Streetmosphere. He's never seen it. I said, no, wait a minute. My friend Eric Jacobson, who's the creative lead on Great Movie Ride, he's had a presentation and a project update every 6 months for the last 3 years. I did one presentation showed them my idea. They said, great, do it. They gave me a budget. I went on an audition tour to 10 cities. And it's the same tour where we hired the cast members for Comedy Warehouse and Adventures Club. And I said, and I haven't had a project update. I want 15 minutes on Hollywood Boulevard with you, Bob Weiss, and Michael Eisner. Well, it ended up being Marty, Bob Weiss, Michael Eisner, Jeffrey Katzenberg, and Bruce Lavelle. And somebody figured out that the meeting must have cost Disney $150,000. And what we did was we programmed a half hour, a streetmosphere where they saw every single character interacting with guests, interacting with each other in costume. So they saw the relationship between one of the policemen. I had tested Autograph Hound at Disneyland, being just a guy asking guests for their autograph. And this was also filmed. I'd love a film of this because there's this family coming down the street. And when you do street theater for a little while, you can look at a group and see who's the live wire there. Sometimes it's the 10-year-old boy. Sometimes it's the grandmother. But every group, every family has one that's the standout. Some families, it's the whole darn family because they're just goofy. So I saw this family coming, and there was a little kid. He had an autograph book, and he was just all excited and bouncing up and down. So I went over to him. I said, excuse me, I've seen all your movies. Could I have your autograph? And I had him my autograph book. And he looked kind of weird at me, kind of, I don't know, should I do this? Looks at his mom. He says, Mom, she says, go ahead, David, give him your autograph. So he gave his autograph very slow. And then I got done. I said, thank you very much. I hope you have a nice day. And he handed me his autograph book and I signed it. And they said, thank you. And they started to walk away. And the mom came running back in tears and gave me a hug. She said, thank you for treating my son normal. Well, the kid was Down syndrome. But my family has a long history of working with people with special needs. And I saw this kid and he fit the bill. He was the most animated guy in his family. Oh, yes. And by the way, he's mentally a little different than the rest of us. In my book, he's mentally a little better. He was perfect for what I was about to do. And I'd done any number of street theater shows over the years where I had picked a kid like that to be in the shows. And they were always, always fabulous. And so I had that on tape. And that was a big hit and made the rounds at the studio and other places. So you imagine me with the Down syndrome kid doing the baggage handler at Star Tours and then the Undertaker. And still, they didn't want to do it at the Magic Kingdom. So you do those kind of things, and people pay attention. And so the streetmosphere is still there. They've recently made some big cuts, including one of their most popular characters. Probably she got too expensive. I don't understand how Disney makes those decisions, but they've cut it way back. But still, 30 years later, it's there.
Streetmosphere is kind of a household name now for those of us that are Disney fans.
It's a word that I made up, and it's used throughout theme park industry. You go to Six Flags, they have listed streetmosphere throughout the park, they'll say. And what it is theming your live entertainment to the area that they're in. In fact, we did that so much. We did a part of our rehearsal for streetmosphere was everybody was assigned to do some research. So that one person did research on what were the popular movies. We picked 1947 as when this was all taking place. So somebody did a presentation to the whole group of here were the popular movies. You're talking about movies of that era, not movies of today. And one of the things we did is what was there, what wasn't there. Well, one of the things that was brand new in 1947 was something called the ballpoint pen. That technology had been invented for soldiers in World War II so they could have a pen that worked out in the field, combat. And so the other thing we did was we didn't cross the middle street. We used the crosswalks and paid attention to the red lights and the green lights. We didn't welcome guests to a theme park. We say, you folks from here in L.A., from some other part, and you've just in Hollywood for the day. Well, the guy that ran all the retail shops liked that. So I did a class for everybody that worked in retail on Hollywood Boulevard. And then I also put all the Disney MGM Studios bands through it. I said, you guys are not in a theme park. You're in Hollywood, California. And when people come through the turnstiles, they're in Hollywood. In the same way that you go to any little theater in America to see a production of Music Man, you may have left your car in a parking lot in St. Louis Park outside of Minneapolis, but you're now in River City, Iowa. So we treat it as a giant set, and we're doing this play every day, and you're a part of it.
Well, that gets into the whole everything is on stage at Disney.
Yeah, we took that to the nth degree.
Yeah, and it makes it fun, too. It really does make it fun and immersive.
Picture. I said when I did the first presentation of streetmosphere, I said, we've built this wonderful set. We need a cast. We need somebody to inhabit it. Our guests won't do it. They're just going to walk through. And they're only going to stop if they go, oh, look, there's the Mars shop. Let's go get a Milky Way. Oh, look, there's, we gave people a reason to be there. And when I was on the roof, Bruce Lavelle, and he was pointing all these characters, occupying guests' time, he just went crazy. They used to do a thing called Star a Day. at Disney MGM. And twice a week for 3 days at a time, they had big, a lot of times old world, but living movie stars there. So they did a little mini parade every day at 3:15. They'd come down in an old classic convertible. I think it was a Cadillac. I think it was early 50s or something. And then they would go to the old amphitheater before they built Hollywood Boulevard. And they would tell stories. They'd show movie clips of theirs. If there was someone who had a musical background, they might sing a song. And then one of our cast members would interview them. We had some of our better people were good at like emceeing things, people that came out of Be a Star TV show and so on. And they, you know, they had some big name folks over the years. So there was a little mini parade, and Streetmosphere was a part of that.
Now, I want to move into some of your signature work that everybody here is going to be familiar with. And that would be the backstory behind the Hollywood Hotel Tower of Terror.
Great. You want me to tell about meeting Walt, or should we do that later?
Talk about your cliffhangers. Meeting Walt. You'll have to tune in to episode 23 to hear that story. If you enjoyed today's episode, I would tell you, be sure to go check out thethinglive.com. McNair will be a keynote speaker there. If you can't make the event, I'm still going to tell you, go over and check out his website, T-T-E-A, with McNair. You can see his TED Talk, all kinds of great stuff that McNair is up to over there on his website. You can even order signed copies of his book, Hatch, Brainstorming Secrets of a Theme Park Designer. Great book. Love it to death. Thank you guys for listening today. Be sure to find us on social media, like us on Facebook, join our MyDVC Points community group there on Facebook, and we'll continue the conversation with all the fans in that group. Thanks for listening, and have a magical day.
Ladies and gentlemen, please watch your head and step as you exit, and take small children by the hand.
Aw, cheer up, Dad. You know I'll come back. With DVC.
My DVC Points is an unofficial Disney-inspired podcast created by fans of Disney Vacation Club. The thoughts expressed in this podcast are personal opinions and personal experiences. My DVC Points is not affiliated with Disney Vacation Club, the Walt Disney Companies, or any subsidiaries. We encourage listeners to contact their DVC guide or member services for official DVC policies.